Four legs good, though two of them are computer generated. In honor of The Call of the Wild, what non-live action animal story from your youth deserves a movie adaptation with Terry Notary playing the animals?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with the Looney Tunes short, I Love to Sing It, about a cute owl named Owl Jolson. And despite what Dave told me before we started recording, it was made not in my youth, but in 1936. But it was still around, and someone should remake it.
I'm at Patches. Red Wall.
And I'm David the Seventh, the only Dave this week on the podcast. And I'm going to say Peter and the Wolf, but real and with like Fantasia like dance sequences.
Fantasia holds up.
Does.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 289, and it is the week of Wednesday, February 19th, 2020. That was the day that in 1960, Bill Keane's Family Circus comic strip debuted.
And they've been using the same art ever since. Boom! Bill Keane.
Oh.
Wow. We still go hard on Family Circus these days?
I struggle describing it as a comic strip because it's really just one
panel. Comic circle.
Yeah.
I read Family Circus more often than I'd like to admit.
Where do you read Family Circus? Do you find it online?
I read an amazing blog called The Comic Curmudgeon, which I would highly recommend to everyone. It's run by Josh Frudlinger. I don't know how to pronounce his name. I don't know how to pronounce anyone's name. But he basically has been reviewing comic strips for the last 15 years online. And he has a wealth of comic strip knowledge, and I will still read a takedown of Family Circus. It's still funny to make fun of this comic. So sorry, Bill Keane, and sorry, dotted line, Billy walking around this. I don't know. It's so stupid. I love it. It's all about God and love.
Now that you're a parent, you really
gotta rip it down.
It.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, thanks for bearing with me last week without me. I was on an airplane, I think, when you guys recorded.
My God, that was so long ago. You were at the Oscars.
It's true. I was not. Well, when you recorded, I was, first of all, I was at the Vanity Fair party and not the Oscars. And then
I'm sorry.
I was on the plane. Anyway, yeah, it was fun.
How was the Vanity Fair party? You saw Brad Pitt.
Saw Brad Pitt with my own two eyes. Watched Kim and Kanye come up to congratulate him.
Really?
Yeah.
And
it was a party full of celebrities.
Were there sparks or... What happens when celebrities of that magnitude get near each other?
I mean, I stand nearby and I'm just like, huh, look at these very famous people who are right there.
There was a surge of light and they created a new single proton in between the three of them.
The core of the Earth stopped spinning and we had to send a mission back.
I actually know how to solve climate change.
Wow.
So I'll share that when I'm ready. Anyway, David's gone now on his like Big Little Lies walking tour, it seems, based on his Instagram. He's just at the Monterey Aquarium and in Big Sur and like watching waves crash into the beach. It seems great, honestly.
It looks nice. But we're on a podcast, so that's almost as good.
I know. Who's going to read our reviews since David's gone?
We have two reviews that we'll catch up with this week. I'll read them. They're short and to the point. Our first up is from What Is Hot May Never Pie, who says, what's up, Mankies? 5 stars. Hi, Mank. This is David Manklick and my inimitable co-hosts, Mank Patches, Dave Mank Gonzalez, and Manky Rich. The last one, not so great. Mank it. I love Sonic the Mankog. Sorry, Bong Joon Mank. Your reign may not survive until next Oscars. Last one. Knock, knock. Who's there? Mank. Mank who? Mank, you glad I didn't say Mank? I didn't understand this review until very late into it, because last week, Katie, we ended by talking about David Fincher's upcoming Netflix film, Mank.
Mank. I knew that that movie existed, which gave me some valuable context for
this. I
think
that has inspired this Mank-filled review. 5 stars to the review, 5 stars to us. And our second review for this week is from Darby Act, who says, amazing, great film podcast, 5 stars. Happy birthday, Aunt Lucy. That dastardly Phoenix Buchanan made off with your pop-up book again. While I try to get it back, I leave you the following gifts. an Aquaman 4K steelbook, a singlet signed by Channing Tatum, a 1950s trade set as sold by Therese, a set of first edition a set of first edition Harry Potter books. Love, Paddington. What is going on in our reviews this week? Just utter chaos.
I don't know. That was great.
That was wonderful.
Both of those A+ reviews.
And that's what you can do in our Apple Podcast reviews. You can write pretty much anything, and then we read it. I guess Apple Podcasts. Do other podcast platforms have review options? Should we be looking there too? We're so focused on Apple. It's such a monopoly.
I'll tell you this, Patches. If you want to monitor other review places and read them out loud at the beginning of the podcast every week, I am all for it.
I will do this. If someone goes on Twitter or sends us a message in another way, like on our fightingintheworm.com, and tells us to look somewhere, I will look there and we will read them.
I love watching Dave delegate.
You could lead up Patches to water, but then he tells the listeners to do it.
He's a real good mech. So this week for our tidbit, we're going to catch up for a movie that I have shamed all of you for not watching earlier so that we could talk about it much earlier. But really, does it matter when anyone watches movies, especially if they're on Netflix? No. So I apologize for all the shaming, and I'm glad that people caught up with this film, which is called American Factory. It was on my top 10 of the year. You can listen to that podcast somewhere on our feed. But this is a documentary from Stephen Bogner and Julia Reichardt. They have now won the Oscar for Best Documentary Film of 2019, and it is very much deserved. It is the story of a plant in Dayton, Ohio. I think it was a General Motors plant that shut down. Tons of people were out of jobs, and Bogner and Reichardt kind of pick up as a new company, this Chinese glass company called Fuyao, comes in and takes over the General Motors plant, hires tons of people who used to work there to make and ship glass. And that's where it all starts. It seems like a really great thing for Dayton, Ohio. I mean, I believe like the mayor of Dayton, Ohio was there for the ribbon cutting ceremony. Everyone thought this was going to revitalize the town. Little did they know that the Chinese do not work the same way as American workers. It's interesting. Fuyao brought over a lot of Chinese workers to kind of teach the American factory workers the ropes of how they make glass in China and how the factories work in China. And the short of it is, you know, Bogner and Reichardt get so much access in this documentary. There are flies on the wall in every kind of scenario where Americans talking to Americans about what's happening, Americans talking to Chinese about what's happening, and eventually later in the film they go to China and we see some of how the Chinese factories work. It's brutal. It is brutal. I mean, they're working around the clock. They're working without safety gloves. It's just a total, you know, there's no regard for unionizing, which is, becomes a factor in the American plant over the course of the time that these two documentarians spend with the crew. There's a lot of culture clash in this film. And I thought in this like volatile political moment, here was something that I thought just like cut deep to what sociopolitical conversations were happening and, you know, we're in the heartland here. And then these are real people dealing with, the global economy. It's just, it speaks on so many levels to me. So I was curious what you all made of American Factory. I can't say it's coming. I don't think any of you watched it on like a wave of hype, perhaps other than my own. But what did you make of American Factory? Was it as startling as I thought it was, or is it kind of like another, I don't know, documentary in a factory line of socially aware documentaries? I don't know if it could ever be,
not for the subject matter, but what makes it so special to me is just the access that they get, the patience that they have to become part of these people's lives, to talk to them, to find new angles in the relationships between these American workers and the Chinese workers. Like, it's this fly on the wall stuff. I mean, I guess not entirely. There's direct to camera interviews, but you think of this period where there's like all these true crime docs on Netflix. There's so many different ways to watch like a documentary thing, and watching people who really know what they're doing just be there and be patient and wait for the story to come and know when the story arrives at them and which threads to follow. It's really impressive to watch it in that way. Even more than the subject matter that they come across, which I think is fascinating too, but watching just the craft on display. I don't know that I don't often feel like I know enough about documentaries to be like, this is good, this is bad. And so often it comes down to like whether or not you like the story it tells. But I feel like watching American Factory, you know how much excellent work has gone into making it.
It is really like a amazingly well edited film, because you have to imagine, as like documentarians, as journalists, they're going in and they're collecting whatever they can. And like you said, Patches, it does sort of follow a couple of threads, but then you know, brings you into the lives of these people. And then, like Katie said, seems to have like an extreme amount of access with the characters they do have, which makes me just feel like, in order for these, because each of the stories that sort of spotlit besides the main company story does have like a three-part arc as like the movie progresses, whether it be unionizing or a woman who used to work at the GM plant and then gets like shunted into company housing that's super tiny. Like everything has like a conclusion to it that's set up at the beginning, and then it all kind of goes through this muddled middle part. Not muddled in the sense of structure, but muddled in the sense that, that neither the Chinese nor the Americans really have any idea what's going on. But to us, the viewer, it's super clear what's going on all the time. So it seems like this is like a really well-crafted film where they had to have talked to dozens of additional characters. But just to have it massaged together the way it is, I think it's really powerful. I do think it gets so interested in all its little pieces that by the time it comes to the end to do like a big, you know, send off and like, this is the end of American Factory, the movie, the titles are about automation, which seems weird. Like a sudden turn, from, you know, trying to make these two things work together, because the Chinese manufacturing culture go over and exist with like a unions, or can capitalism like defeat communism by like making them treat their people horrible. And then the last scenes, which are very powerful, or they're bringing automation to this factory, and it's basically the chairman, the Chinese chairman of the company, walking through, and his, you know, Chinese president, his then Chinese president, since they fired the American one, is walking alongside them, and he's like, these four people aren't fast enough, they'll be replaced by a machine in August. And then the camera keeps moving, so you could just see the other four people who are completely like oblivious to the fact that their fates were just decided as the chairman walked by. It's great, but it seems like a piece apart from what the rest of the movie is about, which is about the workers sort of struggling against the company. I mean, maybe when I say it like that, it makes it sound like...
But isn't that the Chinese ethos, right? Like that they are going to do whatever it takes to not favor the worker? And so many people are. I mean, this Chinese mentality was backed by people in Ohio, by government officials. Like, people wanted this business and philosophy to come in and sweep through the state. And if that means destroying the unions, which the Americans helped do and the Chinese helped do, and then now automation, like anything to hurt the workers is what businesses want to do. It seems kind of in line with the more human side of the drama throughout the film.
I guess it's just the title seems super specific. Like, with it's worded somehow like, by the year 2030, like 350 million people across the planet need to retrain because of automation. And then it goes like from that title to like a montage of the workers coming and going. And the workers are coming and going goes back to like sort of like the one world feel. I just feel like the automation was a little bit of a curveball. But for the most part, like, the most interesting thing to me is this sort of like capitalism just eats the labor force, no matter where it is. If you like let it run rampant, whether it's, you know, in China where the government owns the union, owns the company, so there's the, you know, idea that it's working in efficiency, but like you said, Patches, when we see it over there, it's obviously horrible. Versus, you know, the American thing where they're not meeting quotas and they're in an unsafe environment, and you start to wonder, like, are Americans just lazy? And the film gets to, you know, make you face whatever your opinion is on that subject. It's incredibly balanced, I think, in terms of a union movie.
Yeah, and it's kind of watching each side be kind of dazzled by the other. Like, it's not just that, like, the Chinese come and, like, the relationship is good and then it's soured. It's like watching the Americans go to China. I think that might have been the most impressive part of the movie to me. Like, watching them at this performance at the, what was the occasion that they were having this, like, big show for?
I think just that the Americans were there. They
they had that Happy New Year song with all of the
kids. Oh, it was
kids.
Chinese New Year. Yeah. And it was like watching the 2008, Chinese Olympics opening ceremony again, where you're like, holy shit, there's so many of them and they can do all of this stuff.
There's six marriages at a company party.
Oh my God, I forgot about that part. And these guys are super impressed by it and fascinated by it, just as I think all of us would be. I mean, I don't think the movie is simplistic enough to be like, well, these are just two completely different cultures and they'll never possibly merge, because obviously that's not true. But it does so much to highlight, like, how people can be people and do the same job, but in coming from two different countries, just everything can be so different.
Yeah, I mean, some of the most touching parts of the documentary are when the Chinese workers are living with the guys from Ohio who used to work at the factory, and, you know, they kind of bunked up to learn American culture and just become closer to people, since there was a huge language divide. In the end, Americans and Chinese were working together on the same factory floor. And in the beginning, you're really hopeful. You understand why people were so enamored by this project, and then it's just crushed. It's just so defeating what happens in the second half of this documentary. When you mentioned the chairman, Dave, this diabolical figure. He looks like a caricature of an evil mad scientist or something. He just comes in, he's like, yes, we're going to destroy them all. And like, no, get him out of here. He's so tiny. Yeah, the whole thing's really depressing. And I guess it's just more and more on my mind as we watch politicians running around the country trying to understand, you know, where every single type of American, every single type of person is coming from on this planet, what every person needs. And there's like a human connection lost in a lot of politics that I think this movie gets to. As you were saying, Katie, this is about human connection as much as is globalization, like what's really lost. And I don't know, this movie really cuts deep. And I think just from a directing standpoint, totally deserves the Academy Award. How do they record the audio? How do they record all these conversations when in a loud factory? It's mind-boggling.
Yeah,
I don't know enough
about
microphones.
Think about that. Maybe the factory's not as loud as you think.
They're making glass. I don't know. Okay, aren't all factories loud?
That's one of the funny things is in like an early interview when the factory just opened and things aren't going good. They're talking to some guy and he's like, if there's even the tiniest imperfection, and in the background you hear glass shatter, and he just like stops.
It could be a very funny documentary.
It's really, I didn't see, let's see, I saw Honeyland. I'm trying to think of the other documentary nominees if I saw any of them.
Did you see Fursama?
No, the Syrian ones, Fursama and The Cave, both of them, I didn't have the guts.
You got to build
have
up
it in me.
The emotion, yeah.
But anyway, I thought American Factory was pretty terrific.
American Factory, it's on Netflix for the foreseeable future. It was apparently produced by Barack and Michelle Obama. I think they picked it up after it was made.
They picked it up at Sundance,
you don't
yeah.
really get credit for that. Obama's.
It was the, they didn't get to accept the Oscar.
Sorry. Maybe next time.
Sorry, Obama. No Oscar for you.
But you can watch it right now, and I highly suggest that you do.
Siri, play Castle.
Doing too much.
It's your friend.
She like cash. Bitch, you doing too much. I'm like, shut up, ho.
So, Patches, I'm going to describe to you what I think the Sonic movie is, having not seen it. And when I stop and I'm like, something happens here, you fill in what happens there.
I'd be happy to do that.
All right, here's
Wait, can I just say really clearly, in one sentence, what I think the Sonic movie is?
Before you do that, let's all preempt each other. Have you played a Sonic video game ever in your life, Katie?
Yeah, okay. I never had Sega, but I had friends who did. And I remember Sonic just like rolling into a ball and going around loops. I have
That's
no
right.
memory of a plot, other
there
characters,
no plot.
Anything.
You don't remember Tails? He was the little fox.
Is he a fox?
Yeah.
Does he fly?
He does.
Mm-hmm. I think I might be confusing him with Mario when he gets the feather and turns into a fox and flies.
Yeah, the Tanuki suit.
As many people did.
Anyway, I think that Sonic is basically the 2011 movie Hop, in which the Easter Bunny winds up in L.A. with James Marsden. Sonic winds up in L.A. Oh, but Jim Carrey's not the good guy, so I don't know. That's all I know. He comes to a
You're
portal.
You're like 80% right by just saying that. I mean,
all right, Dave, give me more detail.
All right, so Sonic lives on another planet because he's an alien, and his mentor is a giant owl.
That's right. His name is Longclaw. Actually, her name.
Her name. Longclaw is mentoring Sonic, the fastest being in the universe that we know. And then something happens, and he goes to
Can I tell you
Earth.
What it is?
Yes.
We're just going to spoil everything. So, spoiler.
Well, okay, here's the thing. It's the highest opening video game movie ever last week.
That's right. Bigger than Detective Pikachu. I guess I'm kind of surprised. But
I definitely am, in the sense that I was curious about Detective Pikachu, and I still think it's like a beautiful 35mm film that's about nonsense, and I have no interest in even trying Sonic the Hedgehog. But let me go. So something happens, and he decides to hide out on Earth. What happens?
He is hunted by a tribe of echidnas. And if you play the Sonic 3, you know that's Knuckles' species. So, a little future sequel teasing there. But before we could possibly enjoy this rich, vibrant video game-like world, Longclaw kicks Sonic through a ring portal, and he ends up in Green Hills, Montana.
All right. So in Green Hills, Montana, he's hanging out and he makes friends with James Marsden.
He's more of an outsider. It's a very sad film, I have to say. So Sonic's whole thing is that he cannot reveal himself. You know, he's a monster in some level. So he just hides out in the woods, and like, because he's so fast, he can peek into James Marsden's house and watch him and Tika Sumpter have movie night. And he like,
James Marsden is in this too. I did not
realize really?
That.
I thought you were referencing Hop because you knew James Marsden was in this.
No, because we watched Hop on fucking Netflix or something recently.
Oh, wow. We saw it in theaters together. That's what I thought you were going to remember. You were fondly remembering seeing Hop with me.
No, I definitely have never seen Hop before. Did I see Hop with you?
No, you did. Oh my God. How could you forget Hop? Fuck you.
I don't remember ever
How could you forget
Hop?
The time we saw Hop?
would have sworn on anything that I had never seen Hop before.
Anyway, Sonic's a real loner, and he's a very, very sad boy. And he plays baseball with himself because he can play all the different positions because he's so fast. And then he creates a Sonic boom, and, you know, the government is on his ass, including Dr. Robotnik.
All right, so the government's on his ass with Dr. Robotnik. So he, I guess, reveals himself to his buddy James Marsden.
When he needs help, he needs to, like,
He needs to get to San Francisco where his rings are, but he doesn't know where it is.
That's right.
So despite being the fastest person on the planet, in the universe, the trip from Montana to San Francisco is the plot of this movie.
That it's the middle act of this movie, but there is a tremendous amount of time spent in a car talking about bucket lists between James Marsden and Sonic for a character who can literally, I mean, here's the problem. Here's one of the problems. Sonic is so fast. He can, at some point, he runs to the California coast and back in, you know, 10 seconds, but he still takes a car with James Marsden to get to San Francisco from Montana. Like, it doesn't make any goddamn sense. Just go to San Francisco by yourself, kid. They have a road trip, and they just talk so much. It's unbelievable. Kids are probably enamored. I wrote this in my review for Polygon. I really tried to think about if I was like 7 years old, would I have a different perspective on Sonic? Absolutely. I would never have seen a special effect like Sonic the Hedgehog sitting right next to a person talking. I would never see someone move, go really quick, do like the Quicksilver X-Men special effects scene where everything's slow motion. He's like moving people around. It's the exact same scene out of all the X-Men movies. But now it's for kids. You know, it's definitely Shrek-like. There's so many pop culture references. Sonic flosses. He's a zany character. he farts. They go in one of the bigger set pieces of the movie. They wind up at like a country western bar, full of beer advertisements. I might add, it's just there's so much product placement in this movie. James Marsden, on two different occasions, references Olive Garden's like unlimited pasta bowl, and how great it is. It's just so egregious. But they go to this bar and they get a big fist fight. This is where the Quicksilver scene happens, and then he also eats chili dogs, which Sonic is known to do. And then when he get back to the room, Sonic lets out this just ridiculously wet fart. Like the Foley effects is Oscar winning. And James Martin's like, you might want to check your fur on that one, buddy. Like, that's how disgusting the fart is, that he has to reference that it might trickles of it might be caught in his fur. That's disgusting. What is this movie? It's actually not too bad.
Well, I mean, what I described, first of all, makes no sense to me, and second of all, it sounds bad. But what I haven't described sounds like it could be the more fun thing in the movie, which is Jim Carrey maybe doing Jim Carrey?
Jim Carrey's doing Ace Ventura, he's doing Cable Guy, he's doing The Riddler, he's doing The Mask, he's doing every single character he's ever done, and which makes Sonic the Hedgehog absolutely worth your plane viewing time at some point. This is a quintessential Jim Carrey performance, not to be missed. He seems to have written all of his own lines. I mean, there's some very bizarre non sequiturs in this movie, running parallel. He barely shares screen time with Sonic, probably out of his contractual demands. Like, I will not appear opposite a blue statue who placeholder for CGI. But he is very funny in the movie. Him and Marsden have a few good scenes where they're like puffing up their chests. I don't know. This is not a bad movie. I kind of dug it. It's definitely for kids. Ben Schwartz is very funny as Sonic. It's, I don't know. I, you know, if David were here, he'd be screaming at me and wagging his finger. He really, really hated this. You can go read his review. And, we just have different opinions on like what's acceptable kids entertainment. I don't want stupid shit for the children out there, but I do know that they need like Saturday morning cartoons for an hour and a half with the, you know, with the production budget worthy of a movie that they're going to remember. I definitely think that Sonic the Hedgehog is going to be like defended by 20-year-olds in the year 2038. And we're going to be like, what?
Kill me now.
Yeah. Well, it's just going to be. It's just going to be. It's total fluff. But I will say, like, some of the effects are really cool. I think the action could have been bigger and better if they had the budget. But they're trying to do the game. They're trying to do, like, Sonic spinballs into Robotnik's ship. And they're trying to kind of nod to some of the visuals, and I dig that too. So I don't know. It's not a great movie, but
do you like this Sonic because you work at Polygon and you think about video games all the time?
I don't think about video games at all. That's like the opposite of my job. That's the key. So but no,
like, you're like enmeshed in it. I don't know. Like, you think about video games more than I do.
I mean, I always have from the beginning of my life to now. I don't know.
You shape your life around thinking about video games.
I don't think that influences me. If anything, that makes me harder on them because I see why people like Sonic and I see why people like Sonic the games. And there's going to be a lot of people who love those games who are disappointed by this. Man children who wanted the like gritty Sonic the Hedgehog movie that was never ever going to happen.
Gritty Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yeah.
Shadow the Hedgehog.
I mean, we kind of got, there's a cartoon adventure, just Sonic the Hedgehog, from the early 90s that has like a serious plot. So that's on CBS All Access and Hulu. I was watching episodes of it the other night because I'm a man child, and that holds up. Urkel does the voice.
Huh.
Oh,
well, it just goes to show you. Sonic the Hedgehog in theaters now, doesn't need your money, but isn't a dog, co-starring with Harrison Ford. So pick your poison.
You listen to this podcast or you talk to me in real life, you know that I often complain about not having time to watch movies or catch up on things or like be up to date on the pop culture that I am interested in, but just somehow never get around to. But lately, in the last couple weeks, I think maybe once I got out from under having to catch up on Oscar movies and felt like I kind of had 2019 in the books, I've been kind of poking around on my various subscriptions, and finding old movies that just like catch my eye. And, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, Dave and I, when Dave assigned me to watch Stripes, which is a 80s movie that I had never seen and we hadn't, and you can listen to that episode. And I had watched The Bling Ring at the same time. But I've been, I think partly because of Stripes and partly because of, our friends in the Blank Check podcast are doing a Jonathan Demme series, and they were talking about Philadelphia and Married to the Mob and these 80s and 90s movies that I either hadn't seen or I didn't remember from a long time ago. I've just been kind of interested in watching these movies that are not like the stone cold classics that I need to see to be a proper film education, but like the movies that I am aware of culturally that have been around my entire life that like in some way form the Hollywood that either I grew up with or that we know now, but I had never seen before. And so I rewatched Philadelphia. That was a big one, that was, fantastic. It's on Amazon Prime. That movie is great. I had seen it in high school, but like didn't really know what I was doing watching it. And then this weekend that involved me watching Body Heat because that is on HBO. It was in the like list of movies that will be off the surface soon. Cause this is the thing is like you think you're going to catch up on something and then you realize it's gone before you even get a chance to look at it. Have either of you guys ever seen Body Heat?
I have seen Body
Heat. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes. Lawrence Kasdan directed that movie, right?
Yes. It was, I believe, his first movie or like
after
his first
doing
hit.
Like Star Wars and Indiana Jones.
Writing Star Wars. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He was like the screenwriter, but like is the first movie he directed, I think.
Which is so weird because these are like pulpy, big budget movies. And then he makes what I would describe, I think, if my memory serves me, as kind of like sexual noir, erotic noir.
Yeah, I mean, it is like, so I kind of put it in my brain next to like Fatal Attraction, A Decent Proposal, like all these 80s and 90s sex thrillers, many of which I haven't seen, but in a similar way, kind of know about culturally. But it's like a straight up noir. Like he's like wearing a fedora. Like she's got this incredible like hair that looks like it's, you know, Veronica Lake. Like she is, it is full on tribute to film noir. Which is both interesting and like kind of hilarious just for the way that it's like dated in two different ways.
Well, what grabbed you about this movie, or what is this movie in the grand context of the Hollywood that you're envisioning and the past that you never knew?
It's less about like how it affects Hollywood. It's more about looking at this, like when you get to this movie, you're like, okay, who was Kathleen Turner at this time? Who was William Hurt at this time? Holy shit, Ted Danson in this movie. Why is Ted Danson in this movie? Who was he at this point? And you wind up doing this kind of like anthropology of why this movie came to exist. Which I always just, like, I found interesting when I was in college, of like learning like what made something work the way that it did. That's what I find interesting about the Oscars, that they're like the snapshot of a period in time of like what forces led to making The English Patient the biggest movie in 1996, whatever. And so you look it up and you realize this is Kathleen Turner's basically first movie. Like she just exploded onto the scene with this movie. So I watched Romancing the Stone for the first time a couple years ago. So now I like have that piece of the puzzle that leads me to who she is in Romancing the Stone. William Hurt, it was also like the very beginning of him being a big deal. And it's funny to me to realize that he was just this massive movie star throughout the entire 80s. Like Broadcast News comes 6 years later.
But
he's
was
still
also
playing
like
the young hot guy.
Arty theater dude. Before,
yeah, so. Yeah, and both of those things are happening at the same time. Like, and so he and Lawrence, so he's in The Big Chill too, right? He and Kasdan made The Big Chill after this.
I think that's right.
Yeah, so that's like a huge hit, like kind of another like decade defining movie. And I think it's interesting that by the time I was paying attention to pop culture, really, like I think about Kathleen Turner playing Chandler's mom on Friends. Like she went from doing Body Heat, being like the hottest woman in America, in the world, to playing like kind of a campy role as a character's mom in the course of about 15 years, which I find, I mean,
and between that,
all,
she's Jessica Rabbit.
She has this incredible career, but like just when I caught up with her, she was like the woman who's playing Chandler's mom on Friends. So knowing the context that I had with it and then going back and seeing all the pieces that come together. And it's not like saying like, oh, wow, I've discovered like, you know, Vincent Tamminelli movies. I don't know anything about this. It's watching the things that affected the culture you know of, but like you're getting the history lesson that maybe you didn't think you needed because you like, you know what? You kind of know what Body Heat is, but watching the movie kind of set my mind on all these rabbit holes. And that's what I wanted to talk about.
The rabbit holes.
Yeah. Like what you learn about yourself or the culture that you know about when you see. So the other thing I did is I watched 30 minutes of Beaches because that's also on HBO and I'd also never seen it. And I'm not 100% sure I'm going to finish Beaches. But that's something else. It's like a huge cultural touchstone that you know about even if you've never seen it. And I find it interesting to be like, so what the hell's up with Beaches? John Hurd, who is the dad in Home Alone, is in it as this like sexy West Village theater director. Wasn't expecting that. That was a fun discovery.
I think this is like almost like a Katie Side podcast. That like, no. Like, what the hell is up with Beaches?
Katie Rich. This is Kino Katie from.
Oh my god! No, it really is kind of that. Like, I mean, I don't think I have more glaring movie holes than most people, but I think I care more about filling them. And I find it interesting. I find it interesting to fill them, and I find it more satisfying than being like, all right, I finally sat down and watched Seven Samurai. It's like, hey, Beaches. That's an easy thing I can put on, and like, not have to feel like shamed while I'm watching it that I've never seen it before. It feels low stakes.
That makes sense. I was with the Storm Lost Rewatch Patreon group. We watched Ever After this past weekend together. Drew Barrymore Cinderella story.
I definitely saw that in theaters.
And that is the first movie that I have rented digitally in a long time that I am pretty sure had 135mm transfer, and then they've just never like restored it or anything. Because there are like still frames that jump. There's like scratch textures that's made it through on some of the scenes. The focus pulling's like all over the place. And for me, like revisiting old movies is sort of, it's less like peeling back like weird cultural things that I missed, and more now that I know more about movies, it's interesting how much I like took for granted. So the fact that like a movie frame could be completely editable digitally now in post-production, so you wouldn't have any soft focus stuff in a, you know, movie from 1998, or with stuff like I don't know, Body Heat, or I think Patches said off podcast that he watched Black Stallion recently, which is from the late 70s. But those movies, you know, are trying to get like this really specific look, but all of those movies were made pre-color grading, which was the early 2000s when that, you know, became part of like the complete digital process. So all of those amazing colors, or in the case of like Ever After, they have like some gold glows around certain parts of the frame, those are all, you know, like optical effects that are being used. And the big stunts are like people falling down hills because it's actually a dude falling down a hill. And now you watch it and you're like, if that was a movie today, he would fall off a cliff because it would be a digital body double. And that's just the way he would do it. So I don't know if I've been, I mean, maybe it's to each their own, because it is, does seem very on brand for you to be like, oh yes, let's follow this actress I like, or this movement that I like, and sort of chain it together. Where I would, I most likely, when I fall down these rabbit holes, fall down like either like technical or like weird business rabbit holes. Another one this week, I don't know if this is on topic or not, but I'm on a roll. The guy who produced the first Marvel Studios logo that like aired with Spider-Man, the like flipping pages that came down to say Marvel Studios, was also the guy who produced Blade, who like came to New Line and is like, let's make this a movie. And that's like the two things that he's like known for in the superhero universe. And I'm like, how on earth is this the same person? So I've been,
he produced a movie and then he produced a logo. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. But he produced a movie at a period of time where New Line was just like accepting pitches from people that like could like throw it together. So he packaged the rights and then like the director from this like B movie and then like threw it together into Blade. And then for whatever reason, he's making movies like Blade and Minority Report. And then at some point just decides to have this other life as like a title person. And now he's just like not producing movies. He's making titles. I don't know.
Why not?
Weird.
See, Patches, that's the kind of thing that I find, like, I can, sorry, that I can just, like, learn, like, being, like, read an article, being, like, wow, I am fascinated to learn about this. Or, like, you, like, I listen to the You Must Remember This podcast, and I learn about, like, the careers these people had. But there's a discovery from watching the movies themselves, where I'm, like, how is this star being used? What was this director trying to do with, like, the position that they had in the world? There's, like, I think maybe that's the discovery for me, is, like, I've learned a lot about Hollywood from reading and listening to things, but watching the movies themselves, it teaches me something different.
It turns out watching movies is a great way to learn about movies.
And it's fun.
This is a great time. What I think is so interesting, Katie, is that you're watching a movie like Body Heat, but it doesn't seem like present context is informing your viewing experience at all. You're not revisiting that movie thinking about other things, or being, you know, oh, I just watched a modern noir, or someone is referencing this movie because they're making another movie. You're just experiencing it in kind of a vacuum of the past. Is that right? Or like, are you thinking about anything related to the present when you're watching Body Heat?
I don't know. I mean, you know, you think about like William Hurt as like, you know, whatever, whoever it is he plays in the Marvel movies. But yeah, I don't know. Like,
Dave?
Who does he play
William
in Marvel
Hurt,
movies?
General Thunderbolt Ross.
Of course. I mean, Body Heat, I think, is like, you know, that movie exists. Like, people have talked about it, but I don't think it has a lot of impact. But when Dave and I talked about Stripes a couple weeks ago, I think we both talked about, like, bringing our modern context to something like that. We were like, holy shit, this would not work today for all of these different reasons. I mean, I think we all have talked, at least amongst ourselves, about how, like, the idea of being like, I, as a woke person, 2020, watched this movie from 1990 and found it problematic, how that's, like, not really that interesting a take.
No.
But for something like Stripes, it's kind of hard not to. But no, Body Heat is more about being like, how can I look at this period of history? Like, who are all of these people? You know, these people who I grew up knowing about, like, at a time before I was born, like Ted Danson being this, like, incredibly young, spry guy in a bit role in a noir. Like, it's wild to me that that happened.
Yeah, and I guess my unspoken thought here is that, you know, we have to buy into old movies. We have to really have a reason to, like, work up the courage to sit down and watch a whole movie, I think. And I definitely get this vibe from younger people I talk to who are not necessarily going back to these old movies. It's, they first have to find them, then they have to find a reason why they would watch them, and then they have to actually sit down and watch them. Mm-hmm. And I feel that tug too. But the other day, and I feel like we need to make cases in the kind of modern context to bring people to these movies, and you only discover them when you're actually watching them. That's the problem. How do you do
it? Yeah, I mean, there's old movies like The Apartment is one that I feel I've shown to multiple people who, like, may or may not want to watch old movies because that one feels modern. Like, you can turn on The Apartment and be like, holy crap, like, this works exactly the way that it was intended to.
The script, so maybe that's slaps.
Yeah, I mean, there's like stone cold classics like that from every decade where I think you can put, like, you could show it to anybody and it would work for anybody. So maybe you go from there. But I don't know, there's always new stuff to watch. Like, I still haven't watched Watchmen, even though I want to, because there's too much stuff to watch.
I mean, there is too much stuff to watch. You don't have to do that. If it comes back, maybe you should give it a
try. No, give it a try.
Yeah, it's fine.
I think we're actually going to watch it.
Okay, well, fine, whatever.
I'll be watching Westworld and mad about it.
Rod Patch is watching Watchmen.
Everyone come back and check in with me.
I just watched, as Dave alluded to, the 1979 film, The Black Stallion. It's on Criterion Channel. And why did I watch this movie? I have absolutely no idea. I was just scrolling through, and I just thought that The Black Stallion being on Criterion was weird. I didn't know why it was there.
Oh, that's somebody who's never seen Black Stallion.
That's absolutely right. This film is astonishing. It's directed by Carol Ballard, who did not go on to do too many other things. A lot of animal-related films. The best known one to people listening right now is probably Fly Away Home with Anna Paquin. But this was his debut film. It's produced by Francis Ford Coppola. It's written by Melissa Matheson, who wrote E.T., among other things. And it is pretty astonishing. It is a film that is told mostly in pictures. It's about a boy who's on a boat off the coast of North Africa, gets in a huge boat wreck. He washes up on a deserted island, or, you know, at least on a beach, and has to befriend this wild stallion that wants nothing to do with anyone. And it's shot by Caleb Deschanel, who, most recently, I guess he quote-unquote shot the Lion King remake.
Oh, God.
But has shot many other things.
The person in the wheelie chair with the little tablet.
He's done many things. He did The Passion of the Christ. That's actually a kind of haunting film. He's shot The Natural. He's shot many things, and this film is beautiful.
His career is spoken for itself.
Yeah, this film is beautiful. This film is like just pictures of different vantage points on this island, pictures of this boy communicating with this horse, and it's told with so little dialogue, and the music is wonderful, and there's just so many moments here, and I saw this film maybe like 48 hours after Sonic the Hedgehog, and thought a lot about
as it was intended.
That's
what I was going to say is... The Black Stallion was my Sonic the Hedgehog because my mom used to jump horses competitively, so she's really into horses.
Also, Longclaw's in it.
Is not able to jump horses anymore. So I grew up with you want to watch a movie? Let's watch Black Stallion. So Black Stallion was from a really young age, and then we graduated from Black Stallion to Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken, once we could take a little bit more melodrama. Because
I watched Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken a lot.
What is that like, film about?
Oh, it's about the girl who's like does horse jumping. Like this is a thing. Like must be in the Depression, and like she like rode horses, and then she did a thing where she rode a horse off a diving platform into a pool. Like it made me think that was a thing that happens, which I guess it did. And then she goes blind.
Yeah, it was. Java just discovered that this movie was a thing this week. And I had got to tell this whole my mom kept showing me horse movies growing up. But one way to get people to watch these like older movies is sort of the way I think I've gotten people to watch things like The Warriors. Is like you pick a movie like Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken or The Warriors, and you just describe the plot, and the plot is enough to like hook them in. It's like Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken.
Was a great cultural anthropology that I did because of you, Dave. Like that. Like I thought I knew about The Warriors, and then watching it was fantastic.
Yeah, because it's like if you pitch that to somebody, it's like the movie is there are all these war gangs fighting for Manhattan. They go to have a big summit. Someone kills the gang leader, and they have to fight their way back to Coney Island. You're like, bullshit, that's a movie. And it is. And you could do basically like the same pitch for The Raid, and they're two like different movies. But if you have, I think, that hook that you could put it in, or in the case of something like Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken, like, do you believe that there used to be horse jumping in the Depression and that Touchstone made a feel-good movie about it? I guess it's not Touchstone because it's not on Disney Plus. I definitely looked to see if it was on Disney Plus this week.
Not everything is on Disney Plus.
Black Stallion is beautiful and something you should show your children if they like animals, I'd say.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I mean, it can be a little scary, but I don't know. I guess I thought here's a movie that is not, I don't think it's on the like, film Twitter must see list or something like that. I don't think you'd be shamed for not seeing Black Stallion, or I don't think there's a pressure. I also don't think it's part of the like, the movies used to be better back in the day kind of list. And I don't know. I get a lot of anxiety over telling people to watch old movies because I don't want to offend anyone that hasn't seen something, or I don't want to sound like I'm saying that old movies are better than new movies. I'm trying to figure out how to talk about old movies and try and work up my own courage to go back and figure out how to, you know, what should I be watching? How should I be watching? There's a lot of anxiety to going back.
Well, this is
and
what
seeing
I've been,
this stuff.
This is what I've been enjoying about being like, what is streaming right now that is from a time when I was alive or right before I was born? Like, kind of taking the pressure off of it, of like kind of catching up with stuff that's not like trash, but isn't like the highest of high art that I know I need to have. Like, I'm looking on Netflix right now, and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner is on Netflix, but I've never seen it. And I don't know, like, I feel like I kind of get it. I'm sure I'd be surprised by it, but that feels like something else. I could easily be like, all right, let's see what this movie's all about.
I will say that if you've seen Guess Who, it's not the same. You
I have
should still
not
watch
seen
the
Guess
original.
Who.
Oh, okay. Well, in that case.
All I really know about Guess Who's Coming to Dinner is the concept and, you know, Sidney Poitier and Catherine Ross.
Maybe this is the grand theory that we're coming out with in this very rambly scattershot segment three. Let me throw this out here. No, it's not just about old movies. It's actually the way to approach how to actually watch old movies is watch some of the, like the top 10 highest grossing movies or something from the year you were born, or watch the ones that won Oscars from the year you were born, and then watch the ones from the year your parents were born, and then watch the ones that were from your grandparents' year you were born. I bet that's a quick way to, like, you want to know where your parents came from. You want to know where your grandparents came from. What was playing in theaters when they were, like, doing
no, this? But you should
for
watch some
people
movies that,
younger than us?
Yeah, you should watch the movies that were in theaters when your parents were 10. Because I feel like if you watch the movies from 1994, that would say much more about me personally than from the year I was born, right? Because those movies you saw.
No,
also,
but those
my
movies,
grandparents
the movies
were all
from
born
the year
during
were,
the silent era.
The movies that from the year you were born, you definitely didn't see. So you should definitely go back to see those because it was from a completely
different context. Oh, I see. Oh, yeah. But like for me, I feel like I would learn much more about my parents. Like my mom was born in 1955. If I saw the movies from 1965, that's like something we could have a conversation about.
See, this is a good way to go back. This brings people together.
All right, Dave, we were born the same year of the 1984 top 10. All right, any of these you've not seen?
Top 10 might be the bad way to go cuz that's going to be like
yeah, okay. Let's go.
All right, Ghostbusters.
Definitely seen it.
I didn't
Indiana
look.
Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Very seen happy.
It. Gremlins.
What about the Oscar winners?
Karate Kid.
Seen it.
Have I ever seen the original Karate Kid? Not in its entirety.
Wax on?
No, I'm familiar. Police Academy.
Oh, yes.
I've never seen it.
I did when I was like 13, 12, the perfect age to see
Police Academy. Footloose.
Yes.
Beverly Hills Cop.
Yes.
Star Trek 3.
Okay.
Yes, the 80s God, 1984. 1984 slapped.
Terms of Endearment.
Oh, yes, yes.
And Romancing the Stone.
Yes, yeah, yes.
1984 is a good lineup.
Yeah.
All right, so you want to do Oscar movies? So the 80s and the Oscars were rough.
Were bleak.
Should we...
That just, makes it better.
Are we looping Patches into 84?
We could do Patches, top 10 years of Patches' birth year.
So the movies...
how young are you, Patches?
I'm 86.
1986.
Don't shame me.
All right.
I feel young.
I'm going to do briefly from the 1984... Actually, no, hang on. We need to do 1985 Oscars for the movies from 1984.
We really prepped for this segment. I know. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay, so the 1985 Oscars. The Best Picture winner was Amadeus. Never seen it.
You've never seen Amadeus?
Never seen Amadeus.
Oh my God.
It's like that's getting the 80s Best Picture winners are the last ones, or like the most recent ones I haven't seen. Like I've never seen Platoon.
Amadeus is a very contemporary film. It is a very lively, energized.
I would like Amadeus. But okay. All right. So here are the Best Picture nominees from the year 1984. The handout in 1985. Amadeus, obviously I should see. The Killing Fields. Has anyone seen that?
Is that with Sam Waterston?
That's one about Cambodia. So.
Yeah.
A Passage to India.
I've seen that.
No, I haven't seen it.
Big Movie? Places in the Heart. That one I've actually seen.
I haven't.
That's the Sally Field one. And then A Soldier's Story.
What is that?
A Norman Jewison movie.
Oh. I bet that's good.
See, who's in it? Wikipedia is really bad for this. Who the hell's in this movie? Howard E. Rollins Jr.
I saw the Killing Fields.
Oh, Denzel Washington's in it.
Hey.
A company that was sharing office space with Teen Mom was doing a 3D up conversion of it. So I saw the
3D
Killing Fields sort of by accident.
What? Wow.
Just to test their software. They're like, what do you guys want to update? And some guy's like, let's try the Killing Field.
Wow.
So we watched it, a 3D version of it.
What I'm saying is that the 80s Oscars were rough, but did you know Pat Morita got an Oscar nomination for The Karate Kid? Didn't know that.
He's good.
Okay, see,
that's a good choice.
I think top 10 highest grossing is the way to go. So really? On the way out of this segment, let's do Patches's.
Okay,
1986.
I don't want to. I gotta say, let me hit pause for a second. Yes, 86, I'm sure, is full of movies that we've heard of. But I'm looking at my dad's year, actually. 1959. This is much more interesting.
Oh, okay.
This is how people should...
When you said hit pause, you meant pivot, not stop the podcast.
I'm hitting pause. Okay. I hope you didn't hit pause on the podcast.
Yeah.
I'm pivoting. Okay. I'm looking at my dad's year of 1959. I feel like that's
where
what people
you, where are you finding
on.
Box office numbers from that far back?
I'm looking on Wikipedia. I don't know what it's citing. It's citing Variety from from the year 1990. Okay, that seems fair. Top 10 films of 1959. I think you've heard of most of them, and some of them are bad. Number one's Ben-Hur. That movie kicks ass. Big action movie. Number two's Operation Petticoat. Familiar?
I think I'm getting confused with the Western show Petticoat Junction.
You definitely are, because this movie stars Cary Grant and Tony Curtis, and they're on a submarine.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Big funny movie. Some Like It Hot is number three.
Perfect.
Any of us have seen that movie. Number four is The Shaggy Dog, which you can watch on Disney Plus right now.
Oh, yeah. That one I grew up watching.
Definitely. Disney Channel movie,
that
too.
That was in the top 10 of 1959.
I don't make the rules.
And see, that's from the year my dad was 11, which is why he showed it to me. I'm telling you, 10 years after your parents were born.
Is this all like pre-New Hollywood? So
okay. This is all like weird studio
and
shit.
And the rest of the list is Pillow Talk, Imitation of Life, Suddenly Last Summer, The Nun's Story, North by Northwest, and Anatomy of Murder.
I've heard of all of those except The Nun Story. I've seen a lot of those, actually.
And the Oscar movies are all Ben-Hur, basically. The 400 Blows was up for Oscars of 1959.
I look at 1965, the year my mom was 10. It's Sound of Music, Dr. Zhivago, Thunderball is the top three. Like,
yes!
Like, bam, that darn cat was number five. Who knew?
Yeah, box office may not be the way.
The number four movie of 1965 was called Those Magnificent Men and Their Flying... dot 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 machines. That must have been what the title was.
See, I don't know. I'm gonna still gonna go with top grossing, because the thing is, we've either seen them or we haven't heard of them. It's not that we know they're bad.
Yeah, right? I mean,
I'm so for sure all we know, that thing you just described could be a great movie.
Yeah, I mean, but like, I think I would get more. I would learn more about my parents or about the world that they grew up in, I think, by seeing Cat Blue, which is the number 7 highest grossing movie in 1965, than by reading, by seeing The Killing Fields or something.
That's true. Okay, let's do this. Patches is going to dedicate himself to watching Operation Petticoat, and I will too.
It sounds like we're coming up with our quarter quell. That's
a two dudes watching Operation Petticoat.
Am I watching?
Will be
Police
our
Academy?
Podcast. No. You just get to do your rabbit hole podcast.
Okay, I'm still
like,
all right.
Why Police Academy with Katie Rich?
We're doing Operation Petticoat minute by minute.
Yeah, we'll do the Operation Petticoat minute.
Everyone wants it.
Yeah, they really want it. Yeah, cool.
We
see you
this
guys
out.
Talk about us not planning this podcast as if this is a bad thing. All right, that does it for this week's episode. Presumably David will be back next week if he hasn't been pushed on a flight of stairs by Reese Witherspoon over there in Monterey. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
Spoiler alert. I am Matt Patches, senior editor at polygon.com, where I was not predisposed to like Sonic the Hedgehog, I should just say. But we wrote a lot about it, and you should read it. And we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to episodes, you can share them with friends, or you can direct me personally to other places where you leave reviews. Because if there are other platforms that have review options, I want to read them.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez, but my first name DA7E. You could find me on Twitter at that handle. I'm also on the Storm Lost Rewatch podcast, and you can find that wherever fantastic podcasts are distributed. I'll also give a shout out here to David Ehrlich, who, yeah, isn't here. But you can find him on Twitter at David Ehrlich and find him writing at IndieWire.com.
Good job. I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at VanityFair.com, where the Little Gold Men podcast is taking this week off. So this is the only podcast you'll hear me on this week. But we'll be back next week with 2021 Oscar predictions. Get ready. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KATEYRICH. And we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where honestly, there's so many rabbit holes you could tweet at us about, or you could just answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
In honor of The Call of the Wild, what non-live-action animal story from your youth deserves a movie adaptation with Terry Notary playing?
Am I supposed to be talking about what you guys are doing on the camera right now?
No.
Okay. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week. Make no rats, spin no rats, give a take, give a take. Go, 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 let's go. Cash on me, like I hit the lottery, the lottery. Pose a trip, watch on how they follow me. Wait, honey's blue, yeah, I got them all on me. The pump, then a pump, then get the gunk in the ba bum, ba bum, ba bum. Now I'm done, we're done.